The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, the documentary Common Ground, a follow-up to 2020's Kiss the Ground, examines the U.S. agricultural system and the industrial threats to the nation's farmland. We'll speak with film co-director Josh Tickle. And advanced 3D imaging is letting scientists examine and share museum specimens in a new way. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The 2023 documentary film Common Ground is a sequel to 2020's Kiss the Ground and explores an overlooked resource in the fight against climate change, soil. Co-directed by filmmakers Josh and Rebecca Tickle, Common Ground warns of the threats posed by industrial farming methods to our life-giving resource. I spoke with Josh Tickle about the film that is returning to theaters for Earth Day.
The idea really came 10 years ago when we started the first film, Kiss the Ground. And the impetus was very simple. We're in a climate crisis, and soil can sequester tremendous quantities, possibly all of the CO2 that is currently in the atmosphere. But it has to do so through this process called regenerative agriculture. And that was a fascinating impetus for us to begin investigating the subject and making films on it.
One of the first subjects that you speak with in the film is a farmer whose name is Gabe Brown. And you point out in the film that Gabe has not only managed to reduce his dependency on chemical fertilizers, but he's also managed to make money, too. So how did you find Gabe?
Well, Gabe is known in the Midwest as a beacon of smart, practical, very American farming that's being done in a different way. He lectures quite a bit during the winter, and now his son actually runs the operation. So people know of Gabe. You just have to ask the right people. And once you do, they'll talk the legs off a chair about this guy, because he farms traditional things in non-traditional ways, and the results are astounding.
There's a point in the film where Gabe is standing in his neighbor's land. The land was tilled and the soybeans were planted. And then a few days of 50 mile an hour plus winds, and the topsoil is just blown away. And he took that moment to expand on the larger issue of what he's calling a second Dust Bowl. What do you think of Gabe's assessment and his observations of how soil, topsoil, is at risk of disappearing?
Well, for most of us who consider the Midwest one big flyover state, if you actually don't fly over it, but if you go to it, what you see, especially in places like Kansas, North Texas, and up to the Dakotas, is this chronic loss of topsoil. And it has acute moments of terror when the highways are covered and there are these horrible traffic accidents. But we spend so much time in our car, very few people get out and they go into a field. When you do that, especially in the morning or evening, you're pelted with dust in the Midwest constantly. That dust was once topsoil, and we're losing it at an exponential rate. So current calculations have the loss of the majority of America's topsoil in under 50 years, which you think, well, maybe that's not such a big deal. That's 50 harvests of food, and then we're done. So it's a huge deal. And unfortunately, it's not a, you know, we wait for 50 years and then it's a cliff. It's a slowly diminishing return on our investment into our food system.
Could you maybe help explain some of the tenets of regenerative agriculture?
Well, let me back up just a quick second and say, I think a lot of people would like nature to go back to nature. You know, there's this kind of Bambi ecology idea that we can just let nature go back to itself. But folks forget that humans dominate 3/4 of the global landscape, and we do that through farming, all of it, farming and ranching. So the question may not be, can we let nature go back to nature, but how do we re-engineer, re-manage the process that we're already doing to sustain humanity? And how do we do it in a way that's compatible with climate and health and soil? And then, of course, we can talk about regenerative agriculture.
Sure, let's talk about it.
Okay, sorry. I didn't want to just go on a huge monologue, but the principles of regenerative agriculture are that we're restoring soil health, we're restoring the health of communities, and we're restoring plants and animals. You know, they all seem very obvious, but in practice, the practices are very different than what we do today. So practices involve not tilling the soil. Traditional agriculture, we do a tremendous amount of tilling to reduce weeds and remove, you know, any unwanted plants, reducing chemicals almost to zero in most places. But that's a big one because chemical industries make a lot of money by selling chemicals, and farmers are very dependent on these chemicals. But we're finding that when you increase soil health, you don't need the chemicals, at least certainly not in the vast quantities we use them. And then the other huge one is actually integrating animals. Well, most of the push toward, ecological agriculture involves some level of people saying, well, we don't need animals. No, we actually do. There's no place in nature where there aren't animals. But the way we do animals today is we segregate them and we put them in these huge feedlots, these factory farms, very unhealthy. Regenerative agriculture puts the animals on the land and it moves them constantly. You don't see any lazy cows in regenerative agriculture. They're not just lying around in the field. No, they're moving. They're being moved like predators. And what that does is it makes them grow, makes them only take a little bit of grass and move on. And the grasses grow real tall and the roots go real deep and they suck that carbon down. So animal integration, not tilling, reducing chemicals, those are some of the big, big, big ones. And then cover crops. Never leaving the soil bare in between plantings. You don't let bare soil blow away in the wind like what we're having in the Midwest. You keep a crop, even if it's alfalfa or a mix of seeds, growing all the time. And believe it or not, that soil will start to build. And we've seen soil rebuild. We've seen 100 years of soil get rebuilt in as little as a few years using these methods.
George Washington Carver's research into cover crops and putting nitrogen as a nutrient back into the soil was featured heavily in the film. You know, I think of George Washington Carver and I think of peanuts, and I realized that's about all I knew about him. I hadn't realized that George Washington Carver's legacy touched so much of agriculture and agricultural practices and traditions that date back centuries in some cases.
Well, you know, in the U.S., we tend to have a reductionist view of history when it comes to the winners and losers. And certainly, George Washington Carver was black. He was a pioneer of the regenerative agriculture movement. And we have reduced his role in history from being a hero of black, brown, and white farmers to being the peanut guy. But what he really did is he distilled the idea that nitrogen comes from the atmosphere. You know, we have 80% nitrogen, 20% oxygen and other gases in the atmosphere. Well, why are we buying nitrogen and putting it on the soil? That's what chemical companies sell to farmers. George Washington Carver was dealing with poor people. He said, plant legumes, not just peanuts, but all beans in succession planting, meaning one after another, but the legumes will draw the nitrogen down from the atmosphere and they'll fix it in the soil, making it available for the next crop that you're going to grow. Well, this has been known by Mesoamericans for thousands of years. You know, the three sisters, corn, squash, and beans. You plant the beans before the corn because you need the nitrogen, right? So we're going back to very ancient knowledge. And now George Washington Carver is adding the element of science It was a breakthrough for American agriculture, but it has largely been buried out of our history books.
And a lot of that is because of World War II. George Washington Carver was doing his research in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. You know, 30 years later, World War II hits, and suddenly there's a huge advancement not only in mechanical technology, but chemical technology as well.
Well, exactly. And ironically, the way we eat today, the way we produce food and our entire farming system could be said to run on that war machine. Largely, the post-industrial complex that emerged post-World War II, that is the basis of our food system. We farm largely in sand now in the United States. And the way we get things to grow in that sand is with all of these post-war technologies developed on war technologies. Nitrogen, that was developed because of bombs. We obviously needed lots of bombs for the war. And then, of course, all these synthetic chemicals, those all came from war. So the companies that were involved in World War II in the extraction of fossil fuels and creating those things then had to monetize them after the war. They looked to farms, they looked to farming, and said, look, this is great. We can reduce your pests, we can reduce your weeds, we can increase your fertility. And it all worked very well for a little while. But then the soil started degrading and blowing away, and farmers had to use more and more and more to get the same output. And eventually we got to today, where output per acre has plateaued, but chemicals are going through the roof.
There's been a lot said about Monsanto, who is not only the manufacturer of Roundup, but does a lot of research on pest-resistant crops. However, you take the research in the documentary a little further and talk about how the chemical and the agricultural chemical industry is actually putting its money into agriculture schools, where people are going to college to learn how to be farmers, and following the money from the actual industries that are contributing the funding to the research to the students who are our future farmers.
Well, I liken some of these companies to drug companies. You know, the way you get people addicted to drugs is you get them early and you ensure that they have a constant supply early on. And that's what a lot of these companies have done in regards to land-grant universities. Specifically, there are over 100 land-grant universities in the U.S. They were set up to teach farming. Now, those land-grant universities, like many universities, rely on external funding. 60%, to be exact, of their funding comes from external sources. Who do you think is willing to write huge checks to farming colleges? People who make a lot of money from farming. Just happens to be the same companies that sell those chemicals. So what happens is we tend to educate farmers on this very rote kind of formula card of how to farm. Now, I'm not here to bash farmers. My wife and I are farmers. Farming is so hard. It's so humbling, right? I wish somebody could hand me a directions card each day of how to run a farm. It makes it a lot easier. It makes that hard job barely passable. But what has happened, unfortunately, is it's taken a lot of the innovation out of farming, especially in the United States, and it's made these farmers extremely dependent on exceptionally high cost of seeds, fertilizers, and chemicals. And guess what? Farmers are getting 4 cents dollar we spend. So the big question is, where does the other 96 cents go? And that's the 96 cents that's running the chemical industry.
Now, when we talk about solutions and looking to the future, one of the individuals that you spoke with in the documentary is Senator Mike Braun of Indiana, who, as I understand, stands alone in some way in his views on the agricultural industry, especially as a Republican senator from the Midwest.
Well, we're seeing a few of these guys and gals, you know, from primarily Republican districts who are themselves either farmers or agricultural people. You know, there's another gentleman that appears in the next documentary, Food Inc. 2. He's also a Republican, who's a farmer. And I think if you do farm yourself, or you're involved in agriculture, you get really clear that American farmers are literally dying to feed us. You know, the suicide rate among American farmers is 5 times the national average. Why are farmers killing themselves? The pressure of debt, the intensity of the work, the lack of support. And honestly, they're under these dual pressures, one of which is coming from the chemical companies saying you need to spend more and more and more to produce more per acre. And the other is this mantra of we have to feed the world. And so they're being told that their mission in life is to do this thing, which is untrue. We need to feed our communities first, and then the world will be fed. And then they're being disempowered to do that financially. So I think any leader, regardless of your political stripe, who's familiar with that vexing problem, is going to be a bit of an activist around this issue.
There are a number of celebrities who appear throughout the film. I believe it opens with Laura Dern, and there's Jason Momoa and Woody Harrelson. Why was it important to involve well-known voices, celebrity voices, in the piece?
I think dirt is generally a boring subject. If you say, hey, look, you want to watch a movie on dirt? Most people would say no. You say, hey, you want to watch Aquaman talk about the environment and the things he cares about? People will say, yeah, sure.
Right.
So I think it's just a matter of how do we tell a story that's true and scientific and important and timely and journalistic in an entertaining way. And the best way to do that is with great entertainers. The thing about all of those folks that are involved in the film is the film is a love letter to the next generation. And all of those folks are parents. And as they involved themselves in the film, they all did it for free, by the way. Every one of them. No cost whatsoever. They wanted to do this because they cared about their kids. And they realized, wow, soil's really important. It's the arbiter of the climate. It determines what we eat. It could literally determine whether or not our civilization survives. Okay, big deal. Let me be involved in this. And they were all extremely moved and touched, and they've all been super supportive to come out and help spread the movie.
Now, as another way of helping spread the movie, Earth Day, April 22nd, this film, Common Ground, will be shown in cinemas across the country. Tickets, as I understand, will be at a reduced price. The documentary was released in 2023, but why do you believe it's important to keep making sure that it's seen and it's in theaters here in 2024?
Well, we did a small independent release starting in late, 2023. And at first, we didn't know if the film would really play in theaters. But we started to have people show up in the middle of ice storms, unannounced theaters getting packed all across the country. And so we've tried to expand and super thankful for AMC for jumping on board and helping us do this national Earth Day release with a $5 ticket cap, which is super great. But, what happens in theaters is you see other people and suddenly you go, oh, I can talk to that person. They're my city council person, or that's my farmer. Or, hey, I could work with that person on a community garden. And all these solutions emerge from these communities. It's really a beautiful thing to watch. And it's been an amazing unfolding to have these communities take on Common Ground. What better theme for 2024 than Common Ground? So very excited to see folks at the theater this Earth Day.
Josh Tickle is co-director of the documentary film Common Ground. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The Florida Museum's Open Vertebrate Project, or OVER for short, is providing a unique view of the animal kingdom. Using CT scan technology, the Overt Project has a goal of scanning 20,000 fluid-preserved specimens from museums across the U.S. The project makes visible all parts of the animal, from skin to skeleton. To learn more, I spoke with the University of Florida's Dr. David Blackburn.
This type of high-resolution CT, in many ways, has been around for a while. But one of the things that really has made this project possible is by having many of these instruments located in academic institutions, it means that the cost of using them and maintaining them is much less than it was 20 years ago. So that high-resolution CT, in a way, has been around for quite a while. It's more about the technology becoming more accessible to this community of museum scientists. So by having these now part of many academic institutions, it means that it's within reach for a lot of scientists and a lot of museums that want to do this work themselves, not to have a third party do this, but to have that sort of our own workflow within natural history museums.
Do you have a favorite image that's been scanned? Some of the scans and the images that I've seen are just amazing.
Well, you know, it's like picking a favorite child, Lucas. My favorites really are things because of the impact they've had rather than on the image itself. Sometimes it's unpredictable to me, you know, what are the objects that are going to really capture the imagination of many people? For me, some of our favorite work that we've done have been around imaging skulls. I've long worked on frogs, so we've done a lot of imaging of all the world's frogs, seeing some really truly wild anatomy and frog skulls, all shapes and sizes. One of our most popular animals in the scientific community is a skull. So it wasn't a fluid preserved animal. It was just a skull of a gharial, so a type of crocodilian that's from our scientific collections. It was something kind of done on a whim, to be honest, by a graduate student in my lab who simply wanted a 3D model for doing some outreach and education with. That skull, it turns out gharial skulls are kind of hard to come by. So for the community of scientists out there that study dinosaurs, that study crocodilians, that are interested in paleontology, that are interested in anatomy and skull function, having an easily to access adult gharial skull was very useful to many people.
It may not be too long until you see some of these images hanging on a wall in somebody's home.
Already happening.
Is there an application that you see where these images, these 3D scans, can be used in a virtual space, in VR, for example, or AR, the augmented reality?
Yep, definitely. Already happening. So we have both digital artists, researchers, educators who are interested in using these 3D data in VR and AR applications. My friend and colleague here at the Florida Museum, Ed Stanley, has been working with the University of Florida's Digital Worlds Institute to create VR experiences. So, you know, I saw one recently sort of demoed on the public floor of our museum that was a VR experience sort of simulating paleontological research, right? Digging in the ground, revealing things, finding them. And that was, you know, the object used in that was came from frog skeletons that we've scanned in the lab. So that was what, you know, sort of simulating what a paleontologist does in the field was done using our virtual data that we've created for this project. And so one of the things that's actually been my favorite use of these data have been by artists, whether or not that's artists who are creating their own virtual images, artists that are actually creating sculptures of animals, like three-dimensional real, you know, sculptures, but are interested in getting the details right. We have art institutes, art colleges around the world that have been using our data to show artists who are creating animals or creating organisms that are based on animals, you know, how do animals work? What is the inside of them like? If you want to wireframe a 3D model to walk through a movie, you know, think Jurassic Park, think Avatar. Those animals have internal rigging. If you need to teach artists what animals are like on the inside so they can understand how animals move, the data we have are those type of data those artists want in order to understand how these animals work and look like on the inside.
Beyond the 20,000 specimens that Overt started with as a goal, do you see this work moving forward and just keeping going and evolving and looking at new kinds of objects?
Oh, for sure. I think there's a couple exciting directions. So one is that, we have plenty to scan. There's millions of objects. Scientific collections in natural history museums, of course, not only have vertebrates, we have preserved plants in herbaria. We have fossils in our paleontology collections. We have vast collections of insects that are pinned and otherwise preserved in collections. There's an enormous amount of natural history material out there in collections. So various forms of imaging, it could be 2D, it could be 3D, it could be photogrammetry, it could be CT scanning. There's a treasure trove already available online that you can find and make use of. Many cultural heritage institutions have pages or effectively, I guess I call them web pages or collections of models from specific museums around the world that are shared on the website Sketchfab. So if you look up Sketchfab and search for museums, you'll find many institutions already sharing three-dimensional data from their collections, some of which is free to download and make use of how you'd like to. We'd like to say museums are for everyone, right? Museums are for everyone, regardless of who you are, regardless of what your background is. But here's the reality is that not everybody realizes that behind the exhibits are collections, that behind the exhibits are scientists, whether or not you're an archaeologist or you're a cultural historian or you're a frog scientist, most people don't realize that behind the walls of the museum exhibits are people and collections. And so it's hard to bring everybody behind the scenes, right? It's crowded. We're running out of space to put our things. We can't bring millions of people behind the scenes. But being able to create these sort of realistic looking 3D models of the stuff behind the scenes means that suddenly these 3D models are in classrooms, they're in art studios, they are just being viewed by the public and a wider audience online. And so being able to explore those 3D models up close online, I think is really important.
Dr. David Blackburn is a herpetologist and principal investigator at the Florida Museum's Blackburn Lab. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. If you'd like to tell The Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1752. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.